From Barack Obama to John Boehner and Chris Christie, all political leaders face challenges. A faulty healthcare website, an upstart Tea Party caucus, or a bridge closing scandal. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we examine political leadership and the circumstances that can make that leadership more or less effective. Obama, Boehner, and Christie have all faced different types of challenges, and we'll see how their respective styles impact those tests. Our analysts, two new political scientists to our show, Hans Hassel and David Anderson, along with our veteran analyst, Stefan Schmidt. What about our political leaders make them more or less effective? Join our discussion this Politics Day. First, this news. Politics Day has once again arrived on River to River. Welcome, I'm Ben Kiefer, and joining us today, Stefan Schmidt is with us in our Ames studio, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Stefan, so good to have you with us this week.
It's a pleasure.
With you in Ames is a colleague we have not had on our program before, David Anderson, Assistant Professor of Political Science at ISU. Welcome to you, David.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And another new analyst with our veteran Stefan Schmidt this week, Hans Hassel. He is Assistant Professor of Politics at Cornell College, and he is in our Iowa City studio. Hans, welcome to you.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, the idea we had, gentlemen, for this show was to focus on, give it a theme. Many of our political shows, we just take half dozen or so developments on the landscape and get analysis on them. Today, we want to generate sort of a theme here on political leadership with an examination of three leaders in our news, Barack Obama, Chris Christie, and John Boehner, and have a broader discussion about leadership. And we'd like to have our listeners join in with questions or comments about political leadership. For instance, what do you see as a defining characteristics of each of the leaders that I just mentioned, John Boehner, Chris Christie, and Barack Obama? And perhaps you can come up with a recent challenge faced by that leader to illustrate a defining facet of that leadership. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org is our email. You can always post a message on our Facebook page or tweet us at IPR Talk. Gentlemen, let's start by talking about, he's been in the news. He's been in the news, but he has been in the news this last week. Republican New Jersey Governor Chris Christie gave his State of the State speech at the New Jersey State House yesterday. He included remarks about the scandal that has rocked his administration in recent weeks.
Now, the last week has certainly tested this administration. Mistakes were clearly made, and as a result, we let down the people we're entrusted to serve. I know our citizens deserve better, much better. Now, I'm the governor, and I'm ultimately responsible for all that happens on my watch, both good and bad.
Okay, Chris Christie there talking about what has come to be known as Bridgegate. Stefan Schmidt, let me turn to you first of all. What has this scandal taught us about the leadership of Chris Christie?
Well, you know, he is a very, let's call him aggressive leader. He believes that, you know, he should be right straight at you, hard-hitting, doesn't like the media very much and shows it, doesn't like people who don't follow his leadership or want to support him, apparently, according to what has happened here. That gave him great kudos from a lot of people who said, you know where he stands because obviously, you know, he tells it like it is, no matter how brusque it might be. And so that drove him up in the poll numbers because people like sort of, let's call it bold leaders. And that really was very helpful to him, gave him a tremendous boost for his reelection, which was a blowaway. And so, you know, he's a guy who doesn't mince his words, I guess I would say.
Mm-hmm. And depending on the revelations that come here, we'll find out what other things he doesn't mince. Now tell us, because David Anderson, you are now at Iowa State University, but I understand you were formerly teaching at Rutgers, State University of New Jersey. So you have an insider's view of this, or more inside than we do here in the Midwest in a certain way. What is your take on this scandal that has affected a governor who has aspirations, it is said, for 2016 in the White House?
Well, I think Governor Christie certainly has aspirations for the White House, and this scandal is kind of giving a good test of whether he can refocus the issue. Governor Christie has been really, really good at managing the news cycle. He rarely has to react to news. He always drives the news. And this is one of the first instances where he is being forced onto his heels and he has to react to public opinion. And we're going to find out how well he handles this. And so far, I think he's done pretty well at getting ahead of things. The State of the State address that he gave yesterday really allowed him to take control of the news cycle again. And we're going to see how we can drive it forward.
What about that news conference in which he acknowledged also errors and said, you know, he will keep this breach of trust from recurring? How does he emerge more specifically from the test he's been given that you just described, David Anderson?
Well, the news conference I thought was very interesting. There's kind of a classic tactic in New Jersey politics that if you're hit by a scandal, hold the longest news conference you can, allow the media to ask all the questions they can think of, and then walk away. And hopefully then the issue dies because all the questions have been asked. And Governor Christie held a marathon of a news conference. And after that, people said, well, unless something else happens, the story may be over. What else can we say?
Mm-hmm. Hans Hassel, can he rehabilitate his image, still play on the national stage?
I definitely think that that's still his aspiration. I think that he definitely can. I mean, if you look at poll numbers now, we often have this idea that we need to look at, okay, what is the matchup with him and Hillary Clinton or a variety of other people? And I think that that's overblown. We really need, if you want to get a good gauge as to how this is affecting him, you need to look at what are political elites saying about him. At this point, you're going to get much more information about his viability in the long run by looking at political elites
What political elites are you talking about in this case?
Big donors. You look at party chairmen, elected officials, people, the type of people that can offer him support in an election for the presidency, in a nomination process. I mean, is he going to be able to marshal that support within the party that will get him the nomination? The polls right now are we're so far out from even the first caucuses here in Iowa that they don't really mean a whole lot. They're very volatile still. And so if you really want to get a good sense as to how this is going to affect him in the long run, you should really take a look at what are the elites, what are elected officials saying, what are party chairs saying, what is the donor base saying? And that's much more difficult for us without this insider information to really get a good sense. You might see glimpses of it here or there, but it's more difficult to fully understand what the consequences are.
Stephen Schmidt, do you see it that way?
I think I see it this way. What do you think the reaction of Rand Paul has been to this scandal? What do you think the reaction of Ted Cruz has been? What do you think the reaction of Mike Huckabee has been and of the governor of Texas?
Glee for all.
My feeling is that those elites count a lot as well, and their champagne corks popped when this whole thing blew because they're not interested in Chris Christie doing well in the Iowa caucuses. They're going to resist him. This is going to be dug up. There are going to be all kinds of hearings. And in Iowa, you know, Christie is liked by the country club establishment Republicans who tried to recruit him the last time around. But the Christian base of the party, very conservative and faith-based, they don't like Chris Christie very much. And neither does the libertarian Rand and Ron Paul Tea Party wing of the party. So they're going to make sure that this thing doesn't go away. And they count for a lot because, you know, the money donors are the ones who try to sort of gain the system And they would like somebody, you know, maybe who can get elected nationally. But the contenders in the primaries and caucuses, they want to demolish their biggest threatening opponent. And that biggest, I'm sorry, politically, not physically, is Chris Christie.
Mm-hmm. What is the sense now if there is no, quote, smoking gun tied to Chris Christie that he did not explicitly there some sort of order, command that this bridge shall be closed in part. Can this still follow him, David Anderson, as staff members have been caught through emails acknowledging that this closing of the bridge is some sort of political vendetta against a Democratic mayor?
Possibly. I think the big question is if further connections are found to Christie himself. Without the smoking gun, if there's no direct connection between Christie and the bridge scandal, it may peter out. It's very hard to get.
Well, what if his former staffers go to jail or indicted for something? Won't that haunt him?
It could. But if this is the most severe test of his credibility, it really, I do not think, will resonate around the country. In New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, the tri-state area on the East Coast, issues of traffic really resonate with the public. But when you get outside of that region and outside of metropolitan areas to Republican primary voters, convincing them that causing a big traffic jam is a horrible scandal may take a lot of effort.
Mm-hmm. Hans Hessel.
I was going to say, I think that this lasts only if it's reinforced by subsequent events, right? Yeah. If this leadership style that we've seen come to the forefront, if his campaign is run in a similar way, and there's evidence of that, then this is going to become an issue again and again and again for Christie. But if he can show, hey, this is just an exception, I had a couple of rogue staffers that went off and did this, and I didn't condone it, then I think voters are going to say, look, this is a blip on the page. This is not his style. This just happened to be the circumstances. So it depends on the subsequent events. Are these going to reinforce, or is this an exception from his normal leadership style?
Back to your point, Stefan, about this incident, this scandal, and how it may reshape the GOP in its look toward 2016. Do you think it does at this point, or is that are we not much different than we were a couple weeks ago before this scandal came to light?
Well, you know, my question to you would be, is Chris Christie happy in terms of his future political ambitions that this happened? And the answer is clearly no, that this is a real big distraction. And I think beyond being a traffic issue, which it really isn't, it's not a traffic issue. It's an issue of a bully. It's an issue of someone who has a huge personality that is very often in your face and that can be exploited by his opponents, who are looking for every single piece of material that they can fling at each other, therefore at him. And I come back to the fact that the biggest threat to him are not voters in Quinnipiac polls and other things like that. Nobody gives a darn about them. You know, I don't care what public opinion in New Jersey is about Governor Christie, whether they believe him or not. That's not of any interest to me. What's of interest to me is what are the campaign organizations or the pre-campaign organizations of the contenders who are going to try to derail him doing today? How are they talking about this? What are they planning to do with this besides, you know, hitting him hard for snuggling up to those corrupt left-wing Democrats who run the legislature and the rest of the government in New Jersey, cuddling up to Barack Obama, the great Satan, and the, you know, Islamic socialist who is destroying this country after Superstorm Sandy. Those things are all going to be bundled together. And then at the end, they're going to say, and, you know, he can't run his own staff. They run rogue on him and they go and try to beat up some poor mayors in New Jersey because they wouldn't endorse him. And do you really want somebody like this in the White House? I mean, that's the scenario that I'm looking at. If I'm, you know, the campaign manager or the insiders of the Rand Paul campaign or any of the other contenders who are going to be trying to snatch the Iowa caucuses and then win the New Hampshire primary. So, you know.
Stephen Schmidt is with us, along with David Anderson of Iowa State University. Hans Hessel is with us from Cornell College. Politics Wednesday here on River to River. Looking at some recent developments with Chris Christie, of course, in the news, John Boehner and Barack Obama. We're looking at the issue, the topic of political leadership through these three leaders. And if you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk about what we've found out about the leadership of President Obama through recent revelations. Former U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates released his second book, Duty. It was much anticipated, as he was the only secretary to serve between two presidential administrations of opposing parties. And as expected, people on either side of the political divide read into the book what they wanted to read. Secretary Gates spoke with NPR's Steve Inskeep about some of the criticism in the book leveled not at the president, but his staff.
You seem considerably less respectful of the president's staff than you were of the president himself.
Well, I had a lot of battles with those folks. And frankly, my attitudes were shaped by the fact that I worked in the White House on the National Security Council staff and as Deputy National Security Advisor for nearly 9 years under four presidents. And let's just say that the way it worked in the Obama White House was not anything like I had seen before. I'd worked for probably three of the most significant and toughest national security advisors in our history, Henry Kissinger, Zbigniew Brzezinski, and Brent Scowcroft. And there were things that went on in the Obama White House that, under those three guys, I'm confident would have been a firing offense, such as direct calls from NSC staff members to four-star generals and so on. That just wouldn't have been allowed.
Oh, they should have gone through the chain of command, you think?
Absolutely.
Hierarchy.
Absolutely. Some of the young people in senior positions on the White House staff and National Security Council staff had probably been in college or even in high school when I was the director of CIA. So we just had a different world outlook and a different experience.
Okay. As, of course, President Obama there talking with Steve Inskeep of NPR. Stephen Schmidt, what is the criticism that we've heard in Robert Gates' book? Tell us about Barack Obama's style of leadership and how it's different than other recent presidents.
Well, I mean, I think the main difference is that Obama disagreed with Gates and with the neocons on some of the policies that had been rolled out by the 8 years of Bush in Afghanistan and Iraq and other places. And therefore, the tension that he talks about was more than generational. I mean, it was really on principle. It was probably a questioning of the Bush foreign policy, which was, you know, preemptive war. It may very well have been that for Obama it was a mistake to bring someone from a previous administration or keep them in his administration. That's the problem with bipartisan ideals.
And then
they don't work very well.
And then not ushering him out through the door earlier was because he needed Gates.
Well, he needed Gates to some extent, but you know, I mean, when you come in, it's often truly not a good idea to have someone whose loyalties and political principles are not necessarily with the new administration. That's why presidents are given by the Constitution the authority and the power to basically clean house and replace people with people who will be consistent with the mandate that the president got in his election. And, you know, Obama came in, I think, as a somewhat of an idealist, talking about bipartisanship, talking about, you know, post-racial and post-partisan politics and so on. And Gates turned out, you know, in the end, not to be very comfortable with a lot of the things that were going on with the style of the new president. I think he liked working for Dick Cheney, who was the previous president.
Mm-hmm. Hans Hessel, what is your take on this? Has there been damage done to the presidency through these revelations?
Well, first off, I mean, I think that we have this misconceived idea that the president's power is this power to command, to dictate what the outcomes are and what they want. And I think Stefan made a great point here that he needed Gates, that the president needed Gates in that sense. And that's because the president's power is not the power to command, but it's the power to bargain. So it's this ability to work out negotiations in a give and take environment. And he needed Gates in that very same way. He was a key attribute that gave him credibility to other people that he was negotiating with. And so having that presence there, I think, was very important. And I think that that this idea that these revelations are damaging, I think that you have to also realize that there's a difference in process in the White House than there is in the military. And so Gates' perspective, I think, is very different than the typical politics kind of rough and tumble. One great example of this is when Eisenhower was recently elected, and Truman was talking to reporters and saying, poor Ike. He's going to come here. He's going to sit at this desk, and he's going to say, do this, do that, and nothing's going to get done. And he's going to feel so shocked. And there are fundamental differences between the way things run in the military, where a general gives a command and it's executed, and the way things run in politics, which is the president says, this is what I want. How can I negotiate with you in order to get this thing done?
But evidently, to his military eyes, Gates' military eyes, President Obama acted differently with the military as a civilian in his behavior and his staff's behavior than previous presidents.
Yeah, I think that may be a result of changing politics, right? We have had fundamental changes in politics over the last 30, 40 years. You've seen polarization increase. You've seen an increase of kind of appeals to the public. You have a fundamental shift in the way that politics has played out in the last 30 years, and that may also contribute to this. And so I'm not sure that these are necessarily damaging, more just of a reflection of how things have changed in the last 30 years in politics.
David Anderson, your reflections on the Gates comments about the working for President Obama.
Well, honestly, I'm a little amused by the controversy that they've sparked, because I think both Stefan and Hans are correct that Obama needed to keep Gates in the role because, unlike previous presidents, Obama inherited a war that he campaigned on, saying, I want this to end. I want us to be out of there. I don't think this is something that we can ever declare victory and walk out triumphantly. We're stuck there. We somehow need to get ourselves out. So he kept Gates in because he was the one who was in charge of doing that. But even in the campaign in 2008, there was no indication that Obama was in favor of this war or wanted to stay there. So the revelations to me were just common sense. Of course he didn't support the war and he wasn't enthusiastic about it. And yes, he probably wanted to hear many, many more options and just have discussions about what the possibilities were, because he didn't want to be there. He was very uncomfortable being there.
So this goes on to what the media is being used for here or emphasizes in reports.
Absolutely.
Gates claimed that his memoir on Monday, he said, that had been hijacked by the release of excerpts that had been viewed as critical of the president and of the White House, when there's a lot of criticism to be spread around, David.
Absolutely. I think he's astounded by the reaction it's received. I'm sure he loves the royalties he's getting from the controversy. But the book itself doesn't really seem to be that critical of Obama or the administration. He just says, hey, there are big differences. I believe he says there are some generational differences with the young staffers that Obama's brought in that just don't respect the military chain of command like his generation does.
Mm-hmm. And I think in a recent interview, I think this was Fox News perhaps yesterday, that he was asked what is the biggest national security threat to the United States, and he said it's all within a couple miles on Capitol Hill, the White House and Congress. So that was his answer there, the number one national security threat. We are ourselves the ones we have to fear. 1-866-780-9100, Politics Day, with Hans Hessel of Cornell College, David Anderson, and Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University. Join our conversation as we talk about recent political developments and political leadership more generally this hour. Back to talk about John Boehner and how effective he's been as a leader. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, in 1964, the then U.S. Surgeon General released a report on the hazards of cigarettes. Now, 50 years later, about 22% of Iowans smoke. Tomorrow, we'll assess the state of smoking here in Iowa, including how many young adults are lighting up, smoking bans and marketing restrictions on tobacco, these items called e-cigarettes, and the U.S. government's recommendation that at-risk smokers receive annual lung cancer screenings as part of the Affordable Care Act. Tomorrow on this program, 50 years after the Surgeon General releasing a report on the hazards of cigarette smoking. Today, it's politics, quite something else, smoking. Politics on Capitol Hill, where we're evaluating political leadership, talking about what is at the heart of political leadership through recent events involving some of our political leaders, with Hans Hessel. He is the assistant professor of politics at Cornell College, along with David Anderson, assistant professor of political science at ISU, and our veteran in the group, Stefan Schmidt, a university professor of political science at ISU. We enjoy having you join our conversation. 1-866-780-9100. Before we talk about John Boehner's style of leadership, let's go to our phones. Harry in Parkersburg dialed 1-866-780-9100. Hi, Harry.
Hi.
Go ahead. Welcome to our program.
I just don't understand anyone's accepting Governor Christie's argument about the bridge situation, when basically what he's saying is yes, I was driving the bus. Yes, it went in a ditch. Yes, it hit a tree. But you can't blame me because I was asleep.
Well, what do you think about that, Stefan?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that he can give a 2-hour press conference and he can say, well, I didn't really know anything about this. He's the governor. The buck stops here. It was his staff. It was his closest advisors. And it's just like saying Obama isn't responsible for the failure of the rollout of the Affordable Health Care Act website because he didn't know anything about it. Really, nobody told him.
Mm-hmm.
When you're a leader, that doesn't sell. I mean, it doesn't wash. You know, anything that happens under your administration, under your command, ultimately, the question is, why didn't you know? How come you didn't have more control over your staff? Were they really rogue? Would your staff in the White House do the same thing? Would they just be off doing whatever they want and the president is left clueless of what's going on? Mm-hmm. And if so, that is not a desirable characteristic. So,
David Anderson, do you think people will hold him accountable even if there would be – these are rogue people in his staff? Will he be held accountable?
Well, he may be. The question is, be held accountable by who? New Jersey voters will probably be angry at him for a while, but in New Jersey, he has a great habit of taking control of the message and taking control of the politics of the day. I think the question that most people are asking right now is, how can he move forward with a presidential bid? Are people outside of New Jersey going to really latch onto this? And to keep the bus analogy, I think the question is, are people going to say that his failure to keep that bus out of the ditch and away from that tree, does that mean that he's not qualified to fly the plane of the presidency?
Boy, all sorts of vehicles.
Yeah, that's the real question.
Before we move on to John Boehner, let's Hans Hessel.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, I think that this goes, again, I mean, we all make mistakes. I think every one of us in our jobs and our professions, we're not perfect. The question becomes, is this a habitual process that Christie is guilty of, or is this a one-time thing? If it's a one-time thing, I think that voters are going to forget this. People are going to forget this as a one-time incident where people got out of control and he was not able to control the situation. The question is this a habitual process? Does this reinforce our image of Christie as an aggressive bully, as Stefan put it? And mm-hmm. and are we going to see this again and again and again on the campaign trail in 2016?
Well, what about this David Anderson? What about how could his several of his top leaders think that it was okay to do this? Doesn't that indicate something about the about the climate within his administration?
It very well may, and I think that's kind of the question about where this is going. Stefan's tagging him as a bully. There's a lot of discussion, and there has been a lot of discussion over the last 5 years of whether is Chris Christie a bully. And a lot of people seem to say, well, no, he's kind of a Robin Hood of common sense governance, that he stands up and, yeah, he yells at people, but it's only to make sure that good common sense government doesn't get obstructed by the bureaucracy or these people who are stalling things. But now with this, it's kind of reframing the debate of, well, maybe he is just kind of petty and a bully and he likes to get his own way and his staff believes that this kind of thing is acceptable. I still say the real question is whether anything gets attached directly to him. He did a very good job of firing the people who were clearly connected to the scandal and saying, I take responsibility. They are fired. I cut my my relationship with them, and let's move on. If anything comes out that he is further connected, I think that bully label starts really hitting home.
And I keep repeating, it's really about Huckabee, Rand Paul, and Ted Cruz, who now have a nice target painted on him. And it doesn't matter if this is a big issue. It, you know, the substance doesn't matter. They now have headlines that they can splash in their ads. Absolutely. They can run ads of him apologizing and of the staff testifying and saying, I take the fifth in front of the New Jersey legislature, which some of his staff members are likely to do because they don't want to get incriminated. And that's murder, because those will be in black and white and real slow moving.
Let's move on to a different political leader who, toward the end of last year, received a lot of attention. Let's talk about U.S. House Speaker John Boehner having a tough job keeping his Republican caucus together as we went over that fiscal cliff late last year and weathered a government shutdown. John Boehner has been battling to hold together the party that is made up of now so-called Chamber of Commerce Republicans and also firebrands elected as part of the Tea Party movement. His exasperation at trying to herd cats in Congress finally bubbled over at his final news conference of the year last month.
Well, frankly, I think they're misleading their followers. I think they're pushing our members in places where they don't want to be. And frankly, I just think that they've lost all credibility. You know, well, they pushed us into this fight to defund Obamacare and to shut down the government. Most of you know, my members know, that wasn't exactly the strategy that I had in mind. But if you'll recall, the day before the government reopened, one of these groups stood up and said, well, we never really thought it would work. Are you kidding me? Listen, you all know me, all right? I say what I mean, I mean what I say. I'm as conservative as anybody around this place. And all the things that we've done over the 3 years that I've been speaker have not violated any conservative principle, not once.
Okay, John Boehner last year in one of the most memorable bits of audio from 2013, speaking there, unloading on the Tea Party Republicans in his caucus. Hans Hassel, you have written an article, I think it was back in December, actually, for the Washington Post, and looked at the question why Republicans have repeatedly made John Boehner's life so difficult. What conclusions did you come to? In fact, you have research to back this up, going back to other recent speakers of the House.
Yes, I do, actually. I think this plays into this idea of leadership. We often think of leadership as being entirely on the basis of a person's personality or abilities. And what I found, actually, is that opinions of the speaker are defined very, very fundamentally by situations that are outside of his control. So, for example, one of our research, we looked at public opinion polls about the Speaker of the House dating back to Tip O'Neill in the 1980s all the way up to Nancy Pelosi in 2009. And we looked at what sort of things affect a person's popularity among the general public, but also among members of his or her own party. And what we found actually was that divided government caused decreases in popularity among both parties. So both members of the party of the speaker were more likely to evaluate the speaker at a lower level, and also members of the opposition party were more likely to evaluate the speaker at a lower level when they were in a situation of divided government. What was interesting, however, is that it wasn't for the same reasons. People evaluated the speaker. Members of the opposition party evaluated the speaker at a lower level because they were getting more information about this individual. There was more news headlines. You had more information about what his or her policy positions were. And as a result, members of the opposition party said, okay, wait a second. now that I have him with more information, I don't necessarily agree with him. I don't approve of the job that he's doing. Members of the majority party, however, I mean, in a time of divided government, you would expect members of the majority party to rally around the speaker to kind of support him in this difficult time. It appears that these individuals actually get frustrated with the Speaker of the House and that he's not able to unilaterally implement the party's preferred position. He has to negotiate with the Senate. So Boehner has to negotiate with the Senate. And you saw a lot of things that the House passed not be viable in the Senate. He has to negotiate with the president. The president has this veto on legislation. So partisans of the Speaker's party appear to get frustrated with the Speaker because he's not able to unilaterally implement the policies that the party wants.
Is there a speaker that in recent history that Speaker Boehner is most like in the characteristics that you evaluated?
Well, you see this example of divided government causing this problem in both in Newt Gingrich and also in Nancy Pelosi. So you see a decline in Pelosi's approval ratings up until Obama takes office. You see this continual decline. And then as soon as Obama takes office and she's not in the spotlight but Obama's in the spotlight, her approval ratings jump up. The same thing happens with Newt Gingrich, right? Going back to the last shutdown, major shutdown that we had of the government, it was the shutdown that essentially decreased Newt Gingrich's popularity among his fellow Republicans and ultimately it led to his resignation. He realized that he did not have the support within the party to assure reelection to the speakership. And so he said, wait a second, I'm doing more damage here. I'm not going to be able to be reelected to the speaker. I'm going to resign at this point. And that was primarily as the basis of this negative reaction among his own party stemmed from this government shutdown. I think that we often think of divided government should be this kind of great boon to members of their own party, that the speaker should get even more support. But I think in reality it causes more problems than it actually does for leadership.
David Anderson, what is your view on John Boehner's leadership?
Well, my view on John Boehner's leadership right now is that mainly he has the worst job in American politics right now. I really feel some pity for the man. I don't think there's really a good analogous speaker in recent memory, just because not only does John Boehner have to herd the cats of the Republican Party right now, but then he has both another chamber to fight with and the president to fight with. It is very difficult for him to get anything done. And he even has difficulty with the so-called Hastert rule of the speaker's job should be to put forth legislation that a majority of the majority party supports. I think Boehner has a tough time finding out what a majority of his party stands for anymore.
Mm-hmm. We talked about the research that Hans had done in public opinion polls. Does that matter, Hans? Does it matter how popular a House speaker is?
Absolutely. I mean, these are members of Congress are at least responsive to the constituency of their own party within their congressional district, and so if you see members of a congressional district of a certain party not having a favorable view of the leader in Congress, I think that these members of Congress are less likely to give him support in the passage of legislation. I mean, I think it's essentially a bargaining tool that he has with other members of his constituency, with other members of the party. If his approval is strong among the public that are members of his party, he's going to have stronger support subsequently of members in Congress of that same party.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Schmidt, when Congressman Tom Latham, who is a friend and close political ally of Speaker Boehner's, announced his retirement last month, there was a speculation that Congressman Boehner himself might have the same idea. Do you think he'll leave office, give up the speakership? And if so, under what circumstances? What's he waiting for? Or
he may get run over by a truck, in which case he'll probably leave the speakership. Yes, he'll leave the speakership at some point when the Democrats regain the House, which you and I will not be alive probably when that happens. He may, find other opportunities, but I don't think he's a quitter. I think he wants to see this through. I think he has seen the Tea Party get a little gobsmacked for their shutdown of the government, and they're a little bit more chastised after the Ted Cruz and other incidents, which that was in the Senate, but it nonetheless, I think, sobered up some of his strongest adversaries in the House. And frankly, if you go to the North Grand Mall or to one of the big shopping areas in Iowa City or in Sioux City or Des Moines or somewhere in Iowa with a clipboard, and you ask 1,000 people at the mall who's the Speaker of the House of Representatives, tell me how many people can give you his name, because I know I have some statistics on that. The answer is nobody. And so the approval rating of the Speaker, I don't think it matters very much. It's you know, it's his skill or her skill to be able to assign good offices and good parking spots and do favors for members of their party in the House, and to steer them and to have good whips who can threaten and who can lean over the other members and in private and say, you know, if you don't support what we're trying to do here as a team, I'm going to make sure that your life is made miserable. And I think maybe Boehner hasn't been tough enough with some of his Tea Party opponents, and the Hastert rule is a stupidity and a disaster for any leader to write a rule that says if, you know, the majority of the people on, you know, that are supposedly on in your party don't support something, then you can't get anything done, because then it leaves you paralyzed in cutting deals. The whole role of a speaker and of any politician in Congress is to accomplish things, to pass legislation. And Boehner has been a total catastrophic failure in the sense that this Congress is one of the least productive in the history of the United States. And by that leadership criterion, I think he's going to go down in history as, you know, just having not really understood how you exercise the power. There's nothing wrong with with telling the Tea Party and others, guys and gals, you know, you're going to sink because I'm going to swim and I'm going over to the other side. I need another military base in some district in Texas. And if you're not going to vote for it, I'm going to get the Democrats on board on that, because we have to move the government forward. Mm-hmm. Governing is not not doing anything in paralysis. Government, you know, is in fact accomplishing things, and this Congress hasn't done that.
Let me ask David Anderson this. If we're seeing in recent days a turning of the corner here, yesterday the GOP-controlled House approved a three-day funding extension to avoid another shutdown while Congress hashes out the final details of this omnibus appropriations bill. Looks like possibly this spending bill could become law by the week's end. David, why the sudden urge to compromise? Why so little interest in another showdown? Does it have to do with what Stefan just described, that the new leaders are being herded more effectively now?
I think they are being herded a little bit more effectively. I think a driving force here is the fact that we have an election coming up in November. We have 435 members of the House of Representatives who need to return to their districts and campaign on something. And a lot of the people in the House who've been able to sit around for the last year and do nothing and just say, no, we don't want that, whatever it is, well, they have to come home and say they've done something now. If you shut down the government in an election year, it's almost political suicide. Mm-hmm. So you have to hopefully clear up some of these controversial things in January. And then I would imagine as we get later into the year, we're going to have some more controversial things that will give both the Democrats and Republicans things to go home and stump about.
And in this election year, Americans continue to identify government itself as the biggest problem facing the nation. I guess it's not only Robert Gates. According to a new Gallup poll out today, respondents were asked to name the most important problem facing the country. 21% cited government and politicians. I think that's slightly down from just after the shutdown, but still higher than prior to the shutdown. Hans, you wanted to get in here.
Yeah, I wanted to say, I mean, I think that Stefan is being overly critical here of Boehner's leadership. I think that when we talk about leadership, we often think that it's entirely over the under the control of the individual. But I think that David here has just pointed out a perfect example of why all of a sudden Boehner is a better leader. It's not because he's changed his style. It's because the election is coming up. All of a sudden they have to get something done. And I think that if we criticize Boehner saying, look, you presided over this do-nothing Congress, I think that's being very, very harsh, because it's not necessarily Boehner's leadership style that's causing the problems. It's the political environment. The political environment, I think, affects the ability to get something done far more than anybody's persuasive appeal can. We're overshooting the mark if we say, look, this person is a bad leader because they're not getting anything done. We really need to take into consideration the polarization in Congress, the heightened election season, right? All of these various aspects affect the ability of a leader to get something done. And I think that's really what's driving the problem here. It's not that Boehner is a bad leader. It's that the circumstances are terrible for getting anything done in Congress right now. And that's just the way things are.
Lyndon Johnson would have been able to get stuff done even with this toxic situation if he had had you know, the situation that Boehner had, because Lyndon Johnson knew how to cut deals and how to make deals and how to cut people off and break up his opposition and threaten them and reward them. And I think Boehner has been very passive in that regard. He's just said, I don't have the votes. I don't think he's done a lot of, you know, the stuff that you do in bars and restaurants, smoke-filled rooms. And that's partly because the Congress is now no longer functioning. Congress people don't meet each other anymore. They don't live in Washington. They go to work there 3 days a week, and then they go home.
I want to give Hans a quick chance to respond because we only have about 15 or 20 seconds left, and then we'll call it a day.
I was just going to say this is the perfect thing about hypotheticals, that we can agree to disagree because we have no evidence here. But I have a differing opinion, but I think that's okay here.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much, Hans Hassel, for the first time on our program, assistant professor of politics at Cornell College. David Anderson, assistant professor of political science at Iowa State University, and our veteran Stefan Schmidt, university professor of political science at ISU. Thank you all three for making it a delightful Politics Wednesday once again.
Good show today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much, guys. Tomorrow on this program, assessing the state of smoking. Smoking, not politics. Smoking cigarettes. Tomorrow on this program, perhaps you'd like to join us, especially if you've quit or tried to quit smoking. Join us on our program tomorrow. Our program is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.